This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. In the days after Americans experienced shock and horror at the election of Donald Trump, journalists, activists, and analysts from around the world sympathized and shared advice and experience from their nations. Trump is not unique in his authoritarian and dictatorial behavior or his assaults on our protected rights. Around the world, strongmen have pushed populations to their limits, and ordinary people have resisted and fought back. What can we learn from the struggles of our counterparts the world over? Collecting that crucial advice in a new anthology is my guest, David Cole, the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Review of Books, The Nation, and the author of the books Enemy Aliens and Engines of Liberty. The new book that he has co-edited and whose introduction he has written is called Rules for Resistance, Advice from Around the Globe for the Age of Trump. Welcome to the program, David Cole.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So I remember those articles that popped up in our news feeds from around the world saying, we're so sorry, we get it, we've been there. What led you to putting this book together? Why was it important for us to bring all of this advice into one space?
Well, it's exactly that, that there have been so many other countries that have gone through similar situations. One of the things that I think is most remarkable when you look at this book is that, you know, illiberal autocracies are not exceptional. They're actually quite ordinary. There are many, and so we have, you know, contributions in this book from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, from the Middle East, from Europe. You know, some of the closest parallels are with Berlusconi in Italy. And so we felt, you know, Donald Trump is a new kind of thing for the United States, but many other peoples have dealt with similar kinds of populist illiberal leaders, and we thought it would be useful to see what they have to say about what we might expect and how one most effectively responds.
One of the ones that popped up, and I remember reading this in the days after the election, was from Nadia Tolokonikova of Pussy Riot in Russia, the sort of culture jamming political organization, and that has been under fire personally. And targeted by the Russian regime. And she has this very interesting piece called In Case of Political Catastrophe, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. There's a little video that goes with it, etc. But I thought it was really specific. The very first thing she says is, don't panic. David, there's been a lot of panic in the U.S.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, she says, don't panic. And other contributors say, don't underestimate the threat. Don't be complacent. And I think, you know, both things are true. We can't see this as business as usual. We need to step up. We need to stand up. We need to organize in response. But we also, at the same time, that's right. We can't panic, because if you panic, then you're not responding in a measured and careful and thoughtful and strategic way.
And one of the things that this organization specifically has a lot of experience with is protest, and very creative protest. And she really gives that advice, saying, I want to exist, therefore I protest. Don't sit around like the world owes you something. Fight for your right. If your government is a pile of trash, says Nadia, build your own guerrilla government. How much of the advice that you've collected in this book is exactly that? Get active. Just, you know, become a social justice warrior in the nonviolent sense of the term.
I think that's a fairly consistent theme, but I think it's, you know, there's some people who say, you know, get out in the streets, protest, walk the walk. There are others who say, you know, it's important to not just to protest, but to think about more long-term and institutional responses. It's important. Anne Applebaum, for example, has a piece that says, you know, protest is not enough. You also need to engage in politics, which by which she means engage the political party, engage in an affirmative program. Don't just be negative. Don't just be in the streets. And I think both of those things are true. We need people to come out, you know, things like the Women's March, things like the airport demonstrations in the first day after the Muslim ban was released, incredibly important in energizing people, in sending a message, and the like. But it's also critically important that people engage in a positive way, in an affirmative way, with the institutions that have the more long-term role in pushing back. So, you know, the ACLU, for example. I mean, we're very glad that we've seen so many people come to us. Before Trump was elected, we had 425,000 members. That's a big organization, civil liberties organization with 425,000 members, biggest in the country in terms of broad-based civil liberties. But today we have 1.6 million members, 1.2 million new members as a result of the threat that Donald Trump posed. That's critically important, because then it's people not just getting out in the streets, but actually organizing with others in association to advance liberty in a coordinated and strategic way. And same thing with the groups, the indivisible groups. I mean, this book ends, you know, most of the book is advice from outside the United States, but it ends with the Indivisible Manual, which was written by a number of former congressional staffers about how Americans can most effectively make change happen through Congress. And there are something like 6,000 indivisible groups that have formed, inspired by the manual, and are engaged in the kind of advocacy that we see at town halls and on the Affordable Care Act and the like, that have been very important. So yes, protest is important, but politics and organized civil society resistance is also critically essential. And I think many of the essays make that point.
One of the theme that jumps out at me from the essays collected in this book, Rules for Resistance, is that some of the people under whom others have lived, some of the leaders under whom people have lived, seem to be people that Trump admires. And this, of course, should caution us. Narendra Modi of India, Duterte of the Philippines, Putin of Russia, for example. And it almost seems to be a kind of informal rule that if Trump likes a state leader personally, it's likely because that person is like him or he aspires to be like them. So what are some of the lessons we can learn from Modi's India, from Duterte's Philippines, from Putin's Russia?
So yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, a really interesting question. And I guess, you know, my sense is, yes, he is attracted to strong men. And they are men for the most part. He's attracted to that form of leadership without question. But I think, you know, when you look at the Philippines and Russia versus the United States, we are very different societies. And so, yes, he is admiring of Putin and he's admiring of Duterte, and I'm sure he'd love to exercise the kind of authority that they exercise. But he has not been able to do that. And that's because we have a strong tradition of a civil society, of freedom of the press, that pushes back against and provides protection for, you know, various informal checks and balances, the checks and balances that the media provides, the checks and balances that the academy provides, the checks and balances that civil society provides, the checks and balances that the right to demonstrate provides, right? Those are not, they're sort of, to some extent, well established here in the United States. We have fought for them, people have fought for them, established them, but they're now fairly well established. Many of the countries around the world where strong men have come to power don't have that same kind of tradition. And so it's much more challenging to push back. And so the strong men actually are strong. Whereas Trump is a wannabe strong. He wants to be a strong man, but he's been frustrated from day one in office in terms of trying to get the things done that he wants to get done. Why? Because we are a democracy. And because in a democracy, if the people are against you, you're not going to be able to succeed. And that's so far been the case. So as long as we resist, I think we have a very good shot at reining in Trump in ways that, the Russian people are unable to rein in Putin.
Now, David, in the essay by Nick Robinson on India, Authoritarian Democracy, a Playbook, he says that that what makes these strategies, the strategies that Modi and Trump have used and others of Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, he says what makes them so insidious is that they're generally not unconstitutional or illegal. Instead, these tactics rely on the large amounts of discretion that modern constitutions give to the executive. This discretion is frequently restricted not by laws, but by a set of norms and traditions about what constitutes acceptable executive actions. Can you expand on this a little bit? Because how does this apply to the United States? The right wing accused President Obama of massive executive overreach, and then, of course, had no problem with Trump promptly turning around and exercising those. Obama followed the norms. Trump, of course, isn't.
So, I think Robinson is correct. There is a fair amount of discretion given to leaders in a democracy, and that's true in India. It's true here. The president has broad discretion with respect to how the laws are enforced, how aggressively they're enforced, what resources are devoted to which parts of the law, and the like. And so we saw under President Obama, for example, deportations rose to the highest level they've ever been under any president before, under President Obama. And President Trump wants to increase that even further. That's within their discretion. That was within President Obama's discretion. That's within President Trump's discretion. What's not within their discretion, however, are certain constitutional constraints, the constraints that protect liberty, the constraints that require fair procedures, the constraints that require that you have probable cause before you conduct a search or a seizure. Those kinds of constitutional constraints, the constraint that you can't single out Muslims to ban them from entering the United States, those kinds of constraints are restrictions on the otherwise very broad discretion that the president has. And our job, I think, as citizens is twofold, really. One is to ensure that those constitutional constraints are enforced by supporting and working with the organizations that are fighting back and defending immigrants from unconstitutional actions. And two, where the discretion is not constitutionally constrained, where the president has discretion, we need to make it politically costly for the president to exercise that discretion in ways that are not acceptable to the American public. And, if we do that, again, I think we can rein in his ability to do it.
Finally, David, the last section of your book is about journalism. Very relevant given the battles between President Trump and CNN, for example, that veer into this sort of threat of almost violence. And you have a section on journalism. Mohamed Keita, writing in Quartz Africa last December, said African journalists have tips for their U.S. counterparts on dealing with a president that hates the press. What is the advice that he and other journalists give American journalists for dealing with Trump in this book?
So, I think this is a key question, right? One of the things that not just in South Africa, but in many countries around the globe, we have seen is that when illiberal regimes are in power, they attack the press. They seek to delegitimize the press. They make the press the enemy of the people, to quote Donald Trump. We can't let that happen. We Americans can't let that happen. The press can't let that happen. How does the press not let that happen? I think by doing the work that they always do by sticking to their traditions of courageous, objective, fact-finding, reporting, disclosure, and the like, by digging in where the government would like to keep things secret, by shining light on the kinds of things that the government does in the dark. And Trump doesn't like that. No autocrat likes that, because they operate most effectively when they can operate in the, you know, behind closed doors in the dark. But the job of the press is to not allow that to happen. I think the press has done a pretty good job thus far of focusing their attention on what Trump is doing, on bringing to light the misdeeds and the like. And that's why Trump is so adamantly against the press. But that is a critical part of the separation of powers. It's a critical part of checks and balances. The media is protected not just because speech is important for self-fulfillment purposes, but speech is important to check abusive leaders.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you. We'll post a link to the ACLU's website, aclu.org, from our site later today. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
My guest is David Cole, the National Legal Director of the ACLU, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Review of Books, The Nation, author of two books, Enemy Aliens and Engines of Liberty. We're talking about the book that he has co-edited called Rules for Resistance, Advice from Around the Globe for the Age of Trump. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and on Vimeo.